Greetings and welcome to the IOMSN Town Hall Discussion, Depression and Coping Strategies in MS. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode. A brief question and answer session will follow the formal presentation. If anyone should require operator assistance during the conference, please press star zero on your telephone keypad. As a reminder, this conference is being recorded. It is now my pleasure to introduce your host, Ms. Jennifer Smirka. Thank you, Ms. Smirka. You may begin.
Thank you, Manny. Good evening, everyone. On behalf of the IOMSN and as co-chair for this program, I'd like to welcome you to this evening's town hall discussion entitled Depression and Coping Strategies in MS, presented by Dr. Brant Oliver. As a reminder, these educational sessions will be recorded and they are available as podcasts on the IOMSN website at www.iomsn.org. We'd like to acknowledge and show our appreciation to Novartis for supporting this project through an unrestricted educational grant. So I will begin with introducing Dr. Oliver. Brant Oliver is an ANCC dual board certified family and psychiatric nurse practitioner, as well as a certified multiple sclerosis nurse, as well as an educator and evaluative and healthcare delivery sciences researcher. He holds a Master of Science in Nursing, as well as a Master's in Public Health and a PhD in Clinical Evaluative and Healthcare Delivery Sciences. Dr. Oliver is a nurse practitioner in neurology and psychiatry at the Multiple Sclerosis Center at Dartmouth-Hitchcock Medical Center in Lebanon, New Hampshire, where he has specialized in the care of persons with comorbid multiple sclerosis as well as neuropsychiatric disorder since 2004. In 2006, he actually established the MS Mental Health Clinic within the MS Center at the DHMC, and he's also the director of the Evaluative Sciences Research at the Multiple Sclerosis Center as well, and additionally oversees a comprehensive MS database registry program, which he created and actually instituted in 2008. His research interests include modifiable determinants of psychosocial disability in chronic illness, self-efficacy, and self-management in chronic illness, healthcare quality improvement, and clinical microsystems intervention in healthcare and clinical outcomes research. So, Brant, I would say you've been slightly busy and a bit of an underachiever. However, we are really excited to have you this evening. So please welcome me, join me in welcoming Brant for this evening's meeting. Brant, I'm turning the meeting to you.
Thank you very much, Jen, and also to Lori, the two co-chairs, for inviting me to participate in this innovative teleconference program. It's a great honor to be involved and to be able to share some of my experience with you about this very important topic, depression and coping in MS. This has been an area of particular interest to me over the past decade as I've worked as an MS specialist. My guess is that for those of you who work in MS and see a fairly high amount of MS patients, you're likely already aware that depression is a significant issue and a highly prevalent condition in multiple sclerosis. What I'll hope to do in tonight's program is to start off with a brief 15-minute overview of depression and basic coping and treatment approaches, and then open up the remainder of the program for some question and answer and interactive discussion so that we can get into a little bit more about the questions you may have that are specific to your context or patient population. Throughout this presentation, I'll be referring to some slides that will be posted on the IOMSN Town Hall website. If you don't have access to them now, you'll be able to access them later online. I'll start by giving us a general sense of how much depression we're actually looking at in multiple sclerosis and how that compares to other chronic autoimmune diseases. Depending on which study you reference, the amount of depression ranges from about 26 to 60%. So that's 1 in 4 to 6 in 10 of every MS patient. 6 in 10 of 6 of every 10 MS patients being diagnosed with depression or experiencing depression in their lifetime. So that's very high number. Even if you go with the lowest estimate, 1 in 4 are likely to get depression in their lifetime if they have MS. That's much higher than the national average for those without chronic illness or without multiple sclerosis. These numbers are somewhat similar to other chronic autoimmune disorders like lupus is about a 26% prevalence rate for depression, and inflammatory bowel disease between 33% and 34%. Even type 1 diabetes has a depression rate of about 18%. Psoriasis, 39%, and rheumatoid arthritis as high as 50%. So certainly MS is not alone as the only chronic autoimmune disease that has a higher prevalence of depression than the national population. So certainly depression is a significant problem. However, often there's a lot of ambiguity as to how we actually define depression. If you were to ask 10 people about how you would define depression, or even 10 clinicians, you might get very different answers. And sometimes that can lead to some confusion or ambiguity as to assessing and diagnosing depression. I'd like to go through the criteria for diagnosing the most common form of depression, major depressive disorder, just to orient us to the diagnostic categories. First of all, there has to be either sadness or what we call anhedonia. Anhedonia is the inability to experience pleasure and pleasurable activities. And of those two criteria, actually anhedonia is more predictive of depression than sadness actually is. So you can actually have depression without sadness if there is that anhedonia present. And then in addition to one of those two things, you have to have four of the following things: either sleep disturbance, interest or motivation decrease, guilt or hopelessness, change in energy, change in concentration or cognitive function, appetite change or suicidal thoughts or feelings, or psychomotor retardation, a general slowdown of motor activity. Now, you may be thinking that out of that list, there's a lot of baseline multiple sclerosis symptoms in there as well that may not be due to depression, such as cognitive impairment and MS-related fatigue. And sometimes that can make it difficult to tease out whether we're looking at depression or not. We'll get into that a little bit later. But according to diagnostic criteria, you either need the sadness and anhedonia and four of those symptoms from the list. And again, that list will be on the slides on the website for your reference. The symptoms have to be present for at least 2 weeks consistently, and they have to cause functional impairment in activities of daily living or in social or workplace functioning. Some very important things to think about when we think about depression in multiple sclerosis in particular is that it is related to poor DMT treatment adherence. So disease-modifying therapy treatment adherence will drop in patients that have depression. The relapse rate can often be higher as a result. And also the suicide risk in multiple sclerosis is much higher than the general population, and it's usually correlated very highly with depression. Just read off a few things from a few studies for you. Suicide in multiple sclerosis accounts for 15% of all MS-related deaths. That rate is twice that of the general population and as high as four times that of the general population, depending on which study you would like to try, to quote. And interestingly, even though depression in MS is treatable via the same type of therapies that work for depression in people without multiple sclerosis, less than 30% seek effective care for depression. So we certainly have room to improve in treating depression in multiple sclerosis and in general. The problem with depression in multiple sclerosis is that it has many masqueraders, the first of which is cognitive impairment. Many of you are aware, cognitive impairment is highly prevalent in multiple sclerosis. Depending on which study you choose to trust, between 40 and 70% of the MS population suffers cognitive impairment of some kind, usually affecting short-term and working memory and processing speed. But oftentimes, patients will have mood symptoms secondary to the cognitive impairment. Memory problems and cognitive impairment can be very frustrating to deal with. It can cause a lot of functional impairment, and that can cause irritability and anxiety, and with repeated frustration due to cognitive impairments, can certainly cause a secondary depression. So oftentimes, people who may be presenting with symptoms that suggest a primary depression may actually be suffering from cognitive impairment as the primary problem. The second masquerader for depression and multiple sclerosis is fatigue, which is the most common and disabling symptom in multiple sclerosis, even more so than depression. And oftentimes, especially if the assessment is not thorough, patients with MS-related fatigue can sometimes be misdiagnosed with depression, because if you remember from some of the symptoms I read off earlier, change in energy level and sleep disturbance are two of the criteria symptoms for the diagnosis of depression. So sometimes, especially if there's a quick assessment undertaken, or if MS fatigue is not considered in the diagnostic process, sometimes folks who actually have MS-related fatigue are misdiagnosed with depression. The reason why I bring those things up is because cognitive issues and fatigue are treated much differently than depression is, and being able to appropriately diagnose those can certainly help your patients get appropriately treated faster. There's one additional masquerader I'd like to bring up. It's called pseudobulbar affect. This is a neurological rather than a psychiatric condition. Its prevalence in multiple sclerosis is thought to be low. However, with the emergence of a pharmacologic treatment for pseudobulbar affect, the actual prevalence rate is being studied again. It may actually be higher than was originally thought. The difference between pseudobulbar affect and depression or fatigue or cognitive impairment in MS is that it is characterized by uncontrolled emotional outbursts without the patient actually feeling the emotion associated with it. A good way to explain that is a person at a restaurant suddenly breaking out in laughter, and when later asking that person whether they felt while they were laughing that there was something funny going on, or if they're actually feeling elated or very happy, they'll state that they actually didn't feel happy or elated. It just happened as an outburst, an emotional outburst. That's very different than depression, when a patient will be reporting crying spells, but at the same time feeling very sad. So in that case, they have both the emotion and the behavioral outburst. In pseudobulbar affect, there's the behavioral outburst without the emotion accompanying it. And it's treated very differently than depression is. Nudexta or dextromethorphan and quinidine sulfate is the only currently approved treatment for pseudobulbar affect. I'll touch a little bit on assessment. Obviously, having detailed and thorough assessment is very helpful. In many cases, a general MS practitioner can do a very good job in assessing for depression and multiple sclerosis. In some cases, referring to an MS specialist who is a subspecialist in psychiatric care can be very helpful, especially in cases where it's unclear if it's depression versus fatigue versus cognition, or maybe a combination of things. Helpful are validated screening instruments. And on the slide set that's going to be on the website, I've listed a number of different scales that are valid and effective for screening for different problems, ranging from depression, anxiety, sleep disorders, fatigue, cognitive impairment, and others. For depression, there are a few freely available instruments, such as the Center for Epidemiologic Studies Depression Scale. And that one has been studied and validated in MS. It's actually quite accurate. The Beck Depression Inventory is also very effective, but that one's not available in the public domain. You can use it, but you'll have to pay to use it each time you do. For fatigue, the Modified Fatigue Impact Scale from the MS Quality of Life Inventory is very helpful. The Fatigue Severity Scale, which was recently highlighted in the Counseling Points periodical that many of you may receive, is also very good. For cognitive impairment, the Multiple Sclerosis Neuropsych Questionnaire and others can be helpful. Finally, especially if you're looking to rule out or further assess for cognitive impairment, neuropsych testing can be very helpful. I'm going to move on now to general approaches to treatment and coping of depression. I'll start with three major theoretical approaches that underlie approaches to treating depression. The first is called the uncertainty hypothesis. This is the idea that unpredictability of chronic illness can lead to a decreased sense of locus of control in dealing with a chronic illness and can lead people to feel helpless. Obviously, this theory leads to the idea that educational interventions can be very helpful in treating depression. The second one is the cognitive socio-occupational hypothesis. This is the idea that cognitive symptoms and other psychiatric symptoms can result in social and occupational problems secondary to the autoimmune disease and increase the risk of a mood disorder like depression. This would argue that working to provide social and occupational supports as well as cognitive strategies for coping with cognitive and MS-related impairments impacting social and occupational functioning may make a big difference. And finally, there's a neurobiological hypothesis that suggests that actual MS disease stability may be very important to prevent mood symptoms in multiple sclerosis. There is actually quite a bit of literature suggesting that when there are relapses or increases in inflammatory cytokine activity in the brain, that usually will happen when there's progression of disease or relapses, that that will mess with our mood chemicals, dopamine, norepinephrine, and serotonin, causing imbalances and increased mood symptoms. There is no bottom line yet as to which one of these theories or a combination of theories is the best one or the only one. My sense is that all three of them are likely contributing. Based on those theories, there are five categories of treatments and coping approaches for depression that I'll touch on just briefly. There's the traditional mental health modalities, behavioral medicine approaches, education approaches, environmental supports, and also maximizing non-mental health care approaches. That last one, many people will say, gee, that's not really a mental health approach, but I'll argue that it really should be part of the treatment approach for mental health in MS. In terms of traditional mental health treatment approaches, these are things that are likely coming to your mind already without me even having to tell you. It has to do with medication treatments such as antidepressants and mood stabilizers, anxiolytics, or counseling and psychotherapy, things like cognitive behavioral therapy, problem-solving therapy, manualized homework exercises, or even phone-based approaches have been effective for depression and MS. So those are really the standard approaches that you're probably already aware of. Moving to behavioral medicine, there's a number of non-pharmacological and non-counseling-based approaches that can also be very helpful. Relaxation training, things like meditation, yoga, progressive muscle relaxation, very, very effective in reducing, especially the anxiety component of certain depressive disorders. Exercise, just simply moving more during the day can increase serotonin levels and help with depression. Improving sleep hygiene and sleep structure. If your sleep quality is better, you're going to be better rested. That's going to give you more energy, and it can certainly help with reducing depressive symptoms. Positive reinforcement training. That's a technical term for doing one fun activity per day, even if it's only for 15 minutes. If you do that 3 days out of a week, you get a faster decrease in depressive symptoms than you would get with counseling alone. And more advanced forms of behavioral medicine include biofeedback. Education is another critical category for depression treatment and MS. A lot of the uncertainty around multiple sclerosis or any chronic illness comes around uncertainty about the disease course, treatment expectations, how to assess and report relapses, also about what to expect from disease-modifying therapy. And also what to expect for the relationships between multiple sclerosis and depression. So, for example, educating patients that if depression is increasing, it may be evidence of possible disease progression. And it may also be evidence that to the clinician that adherence to disease-modifying therapy is likely to be decreased as well. Modifying the environment can have critical impact on depression in multiple sclerosis. Simply providing some type of social interaction, especially with peers, family, or friends on a weekly basis, even if it's once a week or twice a week, can have a significant clinical effect as early as 2 to 3 weeks out. Support groups are more formal organizations that provide peer support, advocacy supports for financial management, case management, and legal advocacy can be critical. For many of you who work with MS patients on a daily basis, I'm certainly you can think of a number of them that are really facing tough financial, legal, or case management issues, and especially if those services are not available, can be a real challenge for patients in managing their environment. And finally, I'm going to make an argument for maximizing non-mental health care. Oftentimes, when we think of treating depression or coping with depression, we really focus on the psychiatric component. But I would argue that maximizing multiple sclerosis care, especially disease-modifying therapy, symptom management, coping and accommodation strategies, is just as important. There's quite a bit of evidence showing that with destabilization of general MS status, the likelihood of depression increases, and certainly if you have depression already, if the MS is not stable as well, it's much harder to treat the depression. Also, very important to maximize primary care and rehabilitation. Folks we're treating with multiple sclerosis are whole people, and they are often facing other general medical concerns. So having those managed well can certainly help with treating the depression. And finally, I want to make a real plug for suicide screening and prevention, especially in the MS population. Screening for suicidal ideation is certainly something that should be done regularly and frequently. Screening for suicide is sometimes thought by folks to increase the likelihood of people having suicidal thinking, but that's actually not true. It actually decreases it. So it's interesting sometimes at conferences when I'm talking with clinicians, about half of them will think that asking about suicide frequently will actually increase the risk that people will think about it, but it actually helps to prevent it and reduces the likelihood that your patients will develop suicidal thinking. It's definitely, especially in MS with the higher rate of suicide, is certainly something we should be screening for regularly. So that was quite a bit to cover in about 15 minutes. I'll sum up real quickly by just focusing on a few final points. Bottom line in multiple sclerosis is that depression is highly prevalent. It has a real impact on quality of life, has an impact on disease-modifying therapy, treatment adherence, and most importantly, it's treatable by a number of treatment modalities, including the standard ones, medication and counseling, as well as some of the less commonly utilized ones, such as behavioral medicine and others. In multiple sclerosis, very important to watch out for the masqueraders, especially in someone who may have a long history of treatment-resistant depression. Look for contributions from other common things, such as cognitive impairment, fatigue. Sleep disorders can also be at play in many of these cases. Screening and neuropsychological testing can help. Standard treatments are often effective, and they can often be started by a primary care practitioner or a general MS practitioner without having to wait for the mental health practitioner. For those with more complex or chronic conditions, involving a MS specialist who's also a psychiatric specialist can certainly be helpful to develop a multimodal strategy individually tailored to the patient. So that's a lot for 15 minutes. Let's open it up and see what folks are thinking after hearing all that, and more importantly, to see if they have questions specific to their own practices.
That's great, Brant. Manny, can you go ahead and we'll give the instructions?